From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This election, unlike previous ones, is not the one that the political writers love to write about, treating it as a horse race, treating it as a sporting match, treating political mechanics, inside baseball, and all that kind of thing. This is truly about the direction our country takes into the next century, into the next millennium.
Steve Forbes wins Arizona. Dole takes the Dakotas. A disappointed Buchanan is counting on the South to carry him to victory. Today, we'll analyze the presidential primaries with Congressman Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont and founder of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Also, presidential hopeful Pat Buchanan's been appealing to American workers who've lost their jobs to downsizing, factory closures, and free trade. Union leader Dennis Rivera will join us to discuss what the labor movement can do to counter Buchanan's growing support among the rank and file. That and more coming up on Democracy Now! And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In another triumph for anti-Washington sentiment, Steve Forbes has taken a second straight primary, this time in Arizona, and now is testing his appeal in solidly conservative South Carolina. Dual wins in the Dakotas kept Bob Dole's hopes alive in the GOP presidential contest that scrambles every time the voters speak and don't speak. There is a high number of people who are not going out to the polls, and we're going to be talking about that as well. Today, we'll be talking with National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky, who is still in Arizona for a wrap-up of the primary there. And then we'll be turning to third-term Congressmember Bernie Sanders, founder of the Progressive Caucus. His primary in Vermont takes place next week. We're going to talk to him about progressive politics, congressional politics, and presidential politics. We'll be joined by our co-host in Chicago, Salim Wakil, senior editor at In These Times magazine. And finally, we'll be going to New York with Juan Gonzalez of the Daily News and be talking to Dennis Rivera, who is head of the Health and Hospital Workers Union, a powerful union in New York City. We'll be talking about health care and why it's not being talked about, and we'll be talking about union politics throughout the country. That's all coming up on Democracy Now!
We have an optimistic vision for America. We don't see a negative vision for America. Yeah! There are three basic directions, my friends, that our great country can take. One is the direction that we face today, a direction of incoherence, a direction of drift, a direction of having no sense of direction at all, where the president has to wake up each morning, look at the polls to see what he's supposed to believe that day. That's one direction. Another direction says that America's best days are behind it, that we can't compete anymore in the world, that we have to hide behind walls, sort of a hunker in the bunker mentality. That's another direction. But our direction, the direction that we believe in, is a profound belief that despite the frustrations of the people today, despite the fears and anxieties that are in our land today, we can turn these problems into opportunities and once again, make America that shining city on the hill.
Publisher and also presidential candidate Steve Forbes. With nearly all precincts reporting in Arizona's Republican primary, it looks like Steve Forbes has won with about 33% of the vote. Bob Dole is second with 30% and Pat Buchanan third with 27%. Dole was the runaway victor in yesterday's other two primaries, taking 42% of the vote in North Dakota and 45% in South Dakota. Unofficial returns show Forbes coming in second in North Dakota with 20%, 2 points ahead of Pat Buchanan. Buchanan ran much stronger in South Dakota, capturing 29% of the vote to 13% for Steve Forbes. Lamar Alexander failed to break double figures in any of the contests. Joining us to talk about these latest round of primaries before we move on to South Carolina is Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky in Arizona. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Larry.
Hello, Amy.
Hi. Your assessment of what happened over the last few hours?
Over the last few hours, Steve Forbes, as you just heard, claimed some sort of victory. I think what's going on here now is a complete complete disarray in the Republican electorate. You have people who consistently vote for Pat Buchanan on the right, and his support seems to peak somewhere between 25 and 30% of those voters. We saw it in New Hampshire. We saw it in Iowa. He can't break out of that. He's got the religious right, the militia right, the anti-abortion right behind him, and that's a significant constituency in the Republican Party. It's about 30% of the Republican Party, as I've said on this show before. On the other hand, you have people who are looking for an alternative to Bob Dole because Bob Dole is seen to be lacking in passion, lacking in ideas, lacking in vigor, and all of those things were shown very clearly here in Arizona. Now people are lurching a little bit over towards Steve Forbes. But you have to remember, Amy, that the people who vote for Steve Forbes in the Republican primary are people who would never vote for Pat Buchanan, and the people who vote for Pat Buchanan are people who would never vote for Steve Forbes. Steve Forbes is an old-fashioned patrician, upper-class person. He has not the religious rights point of view on gay rights, to say the least. In fact, his father was gay. He has a very nuanced point of view on abortion. He wishes it would just go away, but it's not just going to go away any more than unwed pregnancies are going to go away and unwanted pregnancies are going to go away. All of these are anathema to the hard right. They're not interested in a Steve Forbes. Lamar Alexander, who seemed like a choice for a while, is a guy who has seen his fundraising fall short. Everybody saw this happening to begin with. He wasn't able to compete here in Arizona. He wasn't able to spend much time here. He didn't run very many TV ads. So you have a very muddied picture right now for the Republicans. Everybody's still muttering about where is Colin Powell.
Larry Bensky speaking to us from Arizona with Forbes at the helm. How much of the issues did Forbes get across? We certainly know about the flat tax, and I was reading some news wires this morning that suggested that 60% of the Republicans in Arizona actually are for a flat tax.
Yes, that's correct. That's what the exit poll said, but interestingly enough, Amy, the economic issues, people who voted on economic issues added up to about 60% of the electorate, those who thought that taxes, deficit, and the economy and jobs were most important. And that's what Steve Forbes talked about here. His TV ads at the beginning, his enormous $3 or $4 million television ad campaign here where you couldn't turn on a news program or any kind of public affairs program without seeing a Steve Forbes ad, they started out attacking Bob Dole and tearing him down. And then at the end, they stopped that. And Steve Forbes ran against the government and the bureaucracy and the IRS. Well, that carries great resonance in an electorate in a state like Arizona, where people are generally Republican, many elderly in the Republican primary, and have an anti-government attitude and certainly don't like the idea of their taxes being raised. So he spoke to them on that level. There was nothing about him here, however, that made him look presidential or that made me think that he was going to be a Republican presidential nominee.
What looks presidential, Larry?
Well, I think everybody here who you talk to thinks that Bill Clinton can't be beat. I mean, if the polls show that the Republican primary voters, all of them thought that Bill Clinton would be nominated in a walk, rather reelected in a walk. The Republicans, 50% of the Republicans said that if Dole was nominated, they would not vote for him in a general election. There's a very strong push towards third partyism happening here, Amy. I think, as I've said from the beginning, that Pat Buchanan is really running for the nomination of Ross Perot's Reform Party. Both of them have giant egos. They would have to be buried for that to happen. But I don't see anything happening from here to the Republican convention that's going to satisfy everybody in the Republican Party, and I see a lot of centripetal forces which would propel that party towards a split and a conservative alternative or a Ross Perot-type alternative third-party movement building during the summer in this country. But you have to remember, most people aren't voting in these things. I think this is really important to note. We had a 25% turnout of Republicans here in Arizona. Everybody's hailing this as a record turnout and a testimonial to the primary, which is complete nonsense. It's a testimonial to the fact that despite the television blitz and all the media hype and everything else, most people don't want to participate in this electoral system right now, not only in Arizona but in the rest of the country, especially in a primary here which was so determined by wealth, Steve Forbes' money being part of it, Bob Dole spending a fortune here as well. And a primary, you know, it's a show called Democracy Now! There could hardly be anything less small-d democratic than this Arizona primary, which was put on the ballot by a gimmick, the first primary Arizona ever had. It was an inside politics job by the governor was a deeply corrupt individual under constant investigation by the federal government, grand jury, etc., a man who was bankrupt, a man who was responsible for $1 billion in losses in SNL. He's supposed to be setting a moral example for the state. He puts this on the ballot in order to get his buddy Phil Graham a start. It doesn't work. Graham drops out, and the Republicans then fragment. Very few places to vote. No way to register in the last 30 days in order to vote. Huge amount of money. So this is not Democracy Now.
Well, Larry, this program is Democracy Now, and we're going to continue to push this issue of elections, of Democratic principles that may not be being followed through on in these primaries and caucuses, but something certainly that people strive for in this country. I want to thank you for joining us from Arizona. We'll be on to South Carolina this weekend, and next week it is the New York primary, so we'll be headed up to New York. Larry, thanks for joining us. On November 6th, 1990, Bernie Sanders won Vermont's only seat in the House of Representatives, defeating a Republican incumbent by a sweeping 16% margin. The first independent elected to Congress in 40 years, Sanders won a historic victory for progressive politics in the United States, the first Democratic socialist in modern American politics to defeat candidates from both major parties in a statewide election. Sanders won his third term in office on November 8th, 1994. Now, it seems a little strange in the midst of the Republican primaries that we've been covering to be talking about progressive politics, to be talking to a Democratic socialist, but what could be more appropriate right now is to hear a different voice. Bernie Sanders is also the founder of the Progressive Caucus in Congress, and we welcome you to Democracy Now.
Amy, it's very nice to be with you.
I also want to let our listeners know that Salim Wakil is joining us from Chicago. Salim Wakil, who is senior editor at In These Times and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times, and he'll be joining in the discussion. Well, what is your reaction to what we've been seeing over the past few weeks, not just Arizona, but the primaries and caucuses so far?
Well, I think Larry made the basic points. I think the first point to be made is that the fabric of democracy in this country is now very, very weak. Let's remember that the so-called Gingrich mandate came in with 38% of the people voting. 62% of the people didn't bother to vote. The vast majority of low-income people no longer participate in the political process or believe that the process is relevant to their lives. And the other point that Larry made that needs to be reiterated is the role of money in politics. Poor Bob Dole, who was for his whole life represented the rich and the powerful, is now on television bemoaning the fact that Steve Forbes bought the election. Well, that's what the system is about. You have the money, you buy it. You buy big houses, you buy big cars, you buy big companies, you buy the presidency. Forbes, I believe, has spent something like $25 million. And remember, he's spending most of that money only on a few states. He's owning the television networks in those states, bombarding people with 30-second ads about the so-called flat tax, which is an absurd proposition. So that's, you have money in politics. And the third issue that is also pretty frightening is there was a study done recently by the Washington Post and some other groups talking about what people know about the political process. And it is frightening. And I think people who follow politics, who are involved in politics, don't really realize what's going out there. And not only the contempt, but the turnoff, the intellectual turnoff that the vast majority of the people have toward politics. You have a situation where something like 75% of the American people cannot name the two senators from their state. Two-thirds of the people cannot name who their congressperson is. They're sure that everybody is doing a good job or a bad job, that they know, but they just don't quite know who it is. You have millions of Americans who do not know today that the Republicans control the United States Congress. So you have a vast majority of our people who don't know very much what's going on, who are heavily influenced by 30-second ads. Then you mix that with what the most important issue is, and that is that the corporate media and the two-party system, in a certain sense, have been lying profoundly to the American people about what's going on in their economy. Just the other day, I read the umpteenth article, I think it was in the Washington Post, should Bill Clinton get credit for our booming economy? These people are crazy. In other words, they keep talking about how the economy is doing very well, and they talk about the stock market being at record level heights. They talk about corporate profits. They talk about unemployment being low, inflation being low. But what they are not talking about is that for 80% of the American people, since 1973, their income, their real income, has either stagnated or has gone down. real wages for working people has declined by 18% since 1972. The gap between the rich and the poor has grown profoundly and is now wider than any other country on earth. The new jobs being created for the young people, it is absolutely scandalous. When we talk about real wages in decline, it is a collapse for the young working people. Young male workers leaving high school, going out into the job market, are making 30% less than was the case 15 years ago. So what the Democrats and Republicans and the corporate media are completely ignoring, and that's an issue that Buchanan has picked up on, is that for the average American, that person is working longer hours for lower wages, that person is in an economic collapse.
Representative Sanders, you know, we go back. I interviewed you when you were back in Vermont as mayor of Burlington. And one thing that always entranced me about you is how you managed to sell progressive policies to the so-called working people of Vermont. And it seems to me that that's what progressives need to be able to do, I mean, to counter the kind of appeal of Buchanan. Why do you think that the right-wing populism or the appeal of someone like Buchanan, who brings a reactionary edge to this complaint, is finding so much success and progressive forces aren't?
Good question, Salim. And I think the answer is, in Vermont, and what I think that has to be done throughout this country, we talk about class issues. In fact, in Vermont, people go crazy. They say, Bernie, don't talk about it again. We're tired of it. Because what we understand, and I think is true, is the average American is hurting, is frustrated, is furiously angry. Pat Buchanan has not a clue about any solution to the problems facing the working class. But all he does do is tap on the anger. So he wants us to hate everybody, and that will be the solution to our economic problems. What you and I and progressives understand is, yes, people are angry. They should be angry. They should be furious. In my state, you have people now working not one job, not two jobs. You have people working three jobs. You have women who would prefer to stay home with the kids now being forced to go into the workforce. People are working longer hours for low wages. Our family farmers are being driven off of the land. People should be furious. They look to the future for their kids. What do they see? If you're making $20,000 a year, how do you spend $25,000 a year sending your kid to college? People don't have health insurance. So they are furious. And then Buchanan comes along, and it is reactionary, racist, sexist, homophobic way. Well, the problem must be gays in America, must be blacks in America, must be Japanese, Jews. You got the people, we'll hate them. And obviously what we are trying to talk about to the workers of Vermont, with some success, is we ignore what the big shots say, and we say, yeah, you have a right to be angry. Let's talk about a progressive agenda. Pat Buchanan talk about raising the minimum wage? Of course not. Does Pat Buchanan talk about growing the trade union movement, helping workers organize? Of course not. Does he talk about a single-payer national health care system? Of course not. He has nothing to say. So in Vermont, and I don't want to overdo it, let me tell you, we have a lot of problems in Vermont, but what we have focused in on is the class issue.
But do you feel like there's a candidate out there? I mean, on the one hand, you have Pat Buchanan, who is racist and a bigot, but he's also anti-corporate, putting out a line
he's
that
a
you don't...
He's a phony anti-corporate. In other words, the only thing... Let's be clear about this, okay? Let's... Where Buchanan has a right point. I was one of the leaders in Congress against NAFTA. I think NAFTA has been a disaster. I think when we have a $160 billion trade deficit, I think we have to be terribly concerned about making radical changes in our trade policy. But Buchanan does not go further than that. A lot of his anti-trade policy has to do with being anti-foreigner. I was watching television last night. He apparently threw foreign correspondents out of a room. I mean, so a lot of that stuff is phony on his part as well.
We're going to talk about how you feel about President Clinton. While this is only one issue, in fact, he was extremely fiercely for NAFTA and paid off a lot of Congress members to the tune of millions of dollars to buy their votes. But right now we have to take a break. You're listening to Congressmember Bernie Sanders, three-termer from Vermont, the only Democratic socialist in Congress and founder of the Progressive Talk Caucus, which we're also going to be talking about. And on the line with us from Chicago is In These Times columnist, senior editor Salim Wakil, who will be continuing to join us after the break. And then it's Juan Gonzalez of the Daily News, who will be talking to Dennis Rivera, who's head of 1199, the local health and hospital workers union in New York, one of the most powerful unions, and they'll be talking about national labor politics, all coming up on Democracy Now! and you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Joining me in the studios here at WPFW in Washington is Vermont Congressmember Bernie Sanders to comment on national politics and his own struggle within the Congress. Also, Salim Wakil of In These Times on the line with us from Chicago. And again, coming up, Dennis Rivera, head of 1199 with Juan Gonzalez. Following up on that question about Bill Clinton and his pro-NAFTA stance, possibly the most corporate president we've had, how do you feel about him and his politics?
Well, I think you're right. Clinton clearly probably worked harder for NAFTA than any single piece of legislation that we have seen. He is pro-GATT. His views on trade, if anything, are worse than George Bush. I think what we have to... I supported Clinton 4 years ago because what I said, and I believe to be true, that 4 more years of Reaganomics and all of the implications of that would have been a disaster for the American working class. We're in a very, very difficult position. Very few people that I know have a great deal of confidence in Bill Clinton. We give him credit for some things. He has been consistently pro-choice. He has not gotten this country, although the temptation is there into any wars where, you know, in the past we invaded little countries and you go up in the polls by 10 points. He has not done that. He has been reasonable. And when he first came in, for example, his original budget, which was much criticized, in fact, raised taxes on the rich, did the right thing, put some money into children's programs. To some degree, he's trying to defend education and so forth. But clearly we know that at best Bill Clinton is a centrist president. Heavily influenced by the big money interest and on many of the key issues is not defending working people. And very few people have any enthusiastic support for Clinton. The question is, what do we do now and where do we go? And I think where we must begin to think is it's in the direction of people like Tony Mazzocchi in the Labor Party and talk about a third party which is based on working people. New Party is doing a good job in various areas of the country, building a grassroots movement. In the state of Vermont, we have been involved in third-party politics for 20 years. I was mayor of the city of Burlington for 8 years as a third-party mayor. Third-party mayor is in power right now. So I think we've got to move in the direction of a broad-based, working-class third party. It is very, very difficult to do. We should not kid ourselves about how easy it would be, but I think that's the direction that we've got to go.
And also, in regards to that, some of Clinton's failings, he also hasn't spoken to issues of race. Nor has the Democratic Party in any really substantial way. And I think that failure to address this continuing problem has allowed the Republicans to kind of define the issue, and I think open the way for Buchanan's rabid expression of it. How do you respond to that?
Well, I tend to agree with you. I think what's happening, there is a huge gap out there. I think what Clinton is trying to do now is say, vote for me. I am not Newt Gingrich and I am not Pat Buchanan. And he's not. I mean, he's not Newt Gingrich and he's not Pat Buchanan. But does Bill Clinton speak to the aspirations and the hopes of people of color, of working people in general? And the answer is very clearly not. And therefore, you have this huge gap out there. I mean, what this election probably about is Bill Clinton may well win because he's not a total reactionary. But then you have tens and tens of millions of people who are hopeless, who are frightened about the future, have nowhere
exactly
to turn. And that's the dilemma of American politics right now. And I think there are two things that we've got to do. Number one, in my view, Salim, and you know, people may agree or disagree with me, I think that the class issue is the fundamental issue. And I think that the great secret that we're not allowed to talk about on corporate media, and I want to congratulate Radio Pacifica. You know, we don't congratulate ourselves enough, but the fact that you have a national radio network that is allowing serious people on the left to talk is extraordinarily important, is that what goes on in America, and Larry talked about it a few moments ago, is the role of money in politics. You have, take a step back, and you look at the absurdity. Steve Forbes, nobody knew who Steve Forbes was in two months ago, and probably 4 months from now, nobody will know who he is again. It's just a question of buying elections. Ross Perot buys elections. 25% of the great revolutionary freshman class are millionaires themselves, broke all the records for getting corporate PACs. Big money dominates the economic life of our country. They decide whether our jobs go to China or reinvested in America. They own the political system. The Republican Party had a fundraiser here last month, $16 million in one night. Gingrich goes out around the country, $10,000 plate fundraising. That's the issue. I'm sorry.
But Representative Sanders, that issue is I agree. I mean, it's very compelling one, and it's one that apparently attracts attention because Pat Buchanan demonstrates it. But it seems to always be trumped by issues of race. I mean, during when the populace put the farmers and the working people together, race came in and destroyed that whole notion of unity. It seems that we are hung up on an issue that we refuse to face and deal with. And I'm wondering, is there any sense on your part that we need to be more explicit in the way we deal with issues of race?
I think absolutely. I mean, of course we do. But I think ultimately a lot of what white, you know, I don't think that a white baby wakes up, you know, at 2 months of age and say, you know, I'm going to dislike people of color. I'm a racist. I think what the Buchanans of the world are able to do is when is racism thrives. You remember what happened in the South in the 40s and the 50s? The white working class in the South was the lowest paid, most exploited white workers in the entire country, correct? What did they have going for them? They had terrible wages, terrible education, terrible living conditions. They could drink out of a white water fountain. They could
exactly
go to a white
right.
bathroom. Boy, wasn't that terrific. That's what they had.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no secret. So I think that racism has been used historically, and you know this better than I do, to divide working people. And our goal is to bring, you know, is every black businessman a progressive? I don't think so. But the goal is to bring black and white workers together. And we have seen that in the early days, you know, way back when. It was very interesting. I attended a UAW meeting in Black Lake, Michigan some years back. And what really impressed me, a lot of the older workers were there, retired workers. And you had people who had worked together in the 40s, you know, when there was an enormous amount of racism going on in this country where half, you know, the South was segregated. These people were close on a very deep level, a lot more than liberals sometimes get together. They were close because they struggled together on the picket lines, and they knew their families and so forth and so on. So I think ultimately, yes, we've got to deal frontally with the ugliness of racism, but we've also got to understand that black workers and white workers and the middle class have got to come together to take on the big money interest.
Congressman Sanders, you talk about Pat Buchanan and the ugliness of his bigotry, but isn't he really actually a very good thing for the Republican Party? Because it makes people like Dole look like they're not the things that Pat Buchanan is. But in fact, Pat Buchanan has got the hot air, he's got the words, and that can shape public opinion since he's got CNN when he's not running for president. But you've got Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, who is passing legislation. You've got people like Newt Gingrich in the House, who's been pretty quiet on Pat Buchanan, but you've got them who are, they may not be using the same exact words, but they are going after the very same people Pat Buchanan is going after.
That's right. Oh, there's no question. I mean, no question. What's going on now, and you're right, there's an irony here in that, you know, we keep thinking, it's funny, now people call Bob Dole a moderate. Bob Dole is not a moderate. Bob Dole is an extremely conservative person. Newt Gingrich is almost looking like a moderate compared to the right-wing freshman members, because then now you got Pat Buchanan making them all, you know, great left-wingers here. But if your point is that the whole Republican establishment has moved extremely far to the right, I know we don't talk about the contract with America. That's now old news because we have Pat Buchanan to talk about. The contract with America and the Republican budget is the most atrocious attack on working people and low-income people in the history of the United States of America. And I suppose that doesn't look so bad compared to Pat Buchanan, but that is the reality.
Let's talk about some of the issues you've taken on over the years, the issues that we do not hear in the media almost at all. For example, your call for a slashing of the military budget.
One of the disgraces that's gone on, oops, I'm sorry, I just knocked the microphone here. One of the disgraces that is going on is that at a time when the Republicans are talking about savage cutbacks in Medicare and Medicaid and education, environmental protection, so forth, and Clinton is going halfway toward their goals, at the same time, both Clinton and many Democrats and almost all Republicans are supporting a $60 billion increase in defense spending over a seven-year period, including, I mean, you're really off into the far end now. I mean, you're really off into Lulu land. The Cold War is over. The Soviet Union doesn't exist. Communism virtually does not exist, at least in Europe. We continue to put $100 billion a year to defend Europe and Asia. No one quite knows what we're defending there, but $100 billion a year. And then Republicans want to build 20 new B-2 bombers at $1.5 billion a plane. The entire budget of my small state of Vermont is about $1.5 billion for 1 year. 20 new B-2 bombers that the Pentagon doesn't even want. And then they tell us that they have to cut back on education, they have to cut back on programs for low-income people, nutrition, and so forth and so on. You're really off in Lululand. And this is an area where there has been bipartisan support, no question about that.
How often are you called, by the mainstream media to debate this issue?
Military, not very much. That has not been an issue. I get on occasionally, the mainstream media, but the issue of the military spending or the CIA, Major Owens of Brooklyn and I brought forth what I think is a pretty conservative resolution that would have called for a 10% cut in the intelligence budget, CIA and the other intelligence budgets. We got less than 100 votes this time. That issue is, that's consensus. That's bipartisan. We all know that despite the end of the Cold War and the needs of working people in America, that we must spend another $60 billion on the bill. Everybody agrees on that, right? The media does, the Democrats do, and the Republicans do.
Congressman Sanders, before we move on, we have a little surprise for you.
As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island.
Bernie Sanders, if you ever want to run for president, you could subsidize your campaign by selling your tape.
Absolutely.
Bernie Sanders and 30 Vermont artists in We Shall Overcome and other pop favorites.
And as people can clearly hear, the good voices were theirs, the poor voice was mine.
You're listening to third termer Bernie Sanders. Did you sing this before you went into Congress?
I spoke it, didn't I? I don't even try to sing. Yes, I was mayor at the time.
We're also joined by Salim Wakil, who is senior editor at In These Times in Chicago. As we talk about progressive politics in this country, Salim, I heard you wanted to say something before that lovely aria.
I just wanted to hear what Bernie's idea, how he felt about E.J. Dionne's contention that a progressive era is upon us.
Yes and no. I think it's not impossible. I think if we can get what we have to understand, and I think as you have already stated, as Larry stated earlier, nobody believes in what's going on right now. You know, Steve Forbes spends $4 million. He wins a primary. Harry Jones will spend $12 million. He'll win a primary. 3 weeks later, no one remembers who these guys are. Most people, I mean, the polls show this over and over again. Nobody believes in the Democratic Party. Nobody believes in the Republican Party. Then what the media tries to do, by the way, it's a riot. For years, people like myself and many others said, we need a third party in America. And everyone goes, don't be silly. America's a two-party system. That's the way it is. That's the way it has always been. Suddenly, when the two-party system collapses, then they want a third party with Ross Perot, with Bill Bradley, with Colin Powell, people who are exactly, you know, moderate Republican types. So I think the feeling is now that people don't look to the two-party system. The feeling is that people are angry and frustrated. It is intolerable. Nobody can defend, Salim, it seems to me, a situation where the richest 1% of the population now owns more wealth than the bottom 90%, where the CEOs of the major corporations now make 200 times what their working people make, right? No one can defend that.
No one can defend it.
And no one even tries to defend it. So the question, though, is people's frustration is there. Do we have the infrastructure, the resources to get the word out to build a third party? And is it possible? I think it is possible. Is it sure that we're going to be able to do it? No, it's not.
How'd you do it in Vermont when you first ran for mayor of Burlington? You were an independent.
Well, Amy, what you should know, and this is an important point to know, we are not like Steve Forbes. My daddy and mommy did not leave me $500 million. They didn't leave me
anything. They didn't love you?
They loved me very much, but they didn't quite leave me the $500 million. So what we did is, and it was done before I was involved, in 1968, I believe, in Vermont. And you have to remember, though, Vermont is a small state. We have probably 25 different radio stations in small towns that have, you know, 8,000 people. We have 11 daily newspapers and so forth and so on. But in the late 60s, both out of the opposition to the Vietnam War and also the plight of working people, in Vermont, a number of people came together. They started a party called the Liberty Union Party. I ran for governor and senator for that party in the early 70s, 71, 72, 74, 76, got up to 6% of the vote. But in all of the races, you had three parties. Vermont is now, for over 20 years, are used to at least three people being in the debates. They have seen alternatives to the Democratic and Republican Party. I was elected by 10 votes in 1981, running as an independent. The day after I won, I knew that we had to build a movement if we were going to go anyplace, and that movement is now probably, it is, the dominant political force in the city of Burlington. We have a statewide coalition, which is not a political party. It is strong. I don't know that we're as strong as the Republicans in terms of our grassroots support, but, you know, we have our problems there. But what I want to point out, we have been doing it for 25 years in one small state, and that's how you make up for the lack of $500 million. So you got to do it over and over again. People, I think, on the left, you know, get discouraged. Gee, we did something, and golly gee, we didn't succeed. I'm all burnt out. I'm going home. It takes a long time and a lot of hard work and determination to build a progressive movement.
Can you talk about these caucus hearings that are going to be taking place on International Women's Day on March 8th, the Progressive Caucus? Now, Progressive Caucus made up of 50 members. That's 10% of the House.
That's right, a little bit more than 10%. Let me just say a word on, thank you for asking me, because we consider this to be very important. When I was first elected in 1990, one of the things that surprised me is that we had all known about the Black Caucus being essentially the Progressive Caucus in the Congress. But it seemed to me there were a lot of white members, there were a lot of Hispanic members, a lot of other people who also were progressives. So what we did, after I was elected, I sat down with folks like Ron Dellums of California and Maxine Waters of California and Pete DeFazio of Oregon and Lane Evans of Illinois, and we sat down and said, let's build a progressive caucus as well to bring more people together. We started with five. We now are, with the election of Jesse Jackson Jr., we're now up to 50. What we are going to be doing on March 8th, I think, is very, very important. The rough title of the hearing is going to be The Collapse of the Middle Class. What's going on and how do we remedy it? What we are going to do is bring working people, low-income workers, middle-class workers, the people who are being laid off from Lockheed Martin, the people who are being laid off from AT&T, the people who are trying to get by on $5 or $6 an hour, and they're going to tell us how great this economy is. You know, we hear about all the jobs that are being created, the economy is booming. Well, they're going to tell us what happens to a 50-year-old worker who's making $30,000 or $40,000 a year and loses his or her job. And we're going to find out about how you survive on $5 or $6 an hour. And then what we're going to do is we have some people who, you know, have some economic background. I think, in fact, former Governor Mario Cuomo will be testifying as well, who has done some work on us, talk about what's going on in terms of the income gap and the growing gap between the rich and the poor. We're going to have Warren Peterson, who wrote a very good book called The Silent Depression, which is, I think, a very apt title for what's going on right now. We're going to have some folks from the Economic Policy Institute analyzing what's going on. So we're going to do it both from a human point of view. We're going to talk to workers who are really suffering the brunt of what's going on in this economy, and economists who can perhaps explain to us what's going on. And also we want some ideas as to how we can turn the economic situation around, get wages to rise in this country, get companies to reinvest in America. And it's going to be a very important hearing.
And it's an excellent opportunity to draw a distinction between your ideas and those of Pat Buchanan.
You got it. You got it, Selim. That's exactly right.
What's your alternative to Steve Forbes' flat tax?
It's a very old-fashioned idea. I know I'm kind of boring and old-fashioned about this, but I think when the richest 1% are the people who are basically getting all of the increased income now, and the richest 1% own more wealth than the bottom 90%, I know this will shock people. I kind of think it's appropriate to tax those people who have the money. So I believe in an old-fashioned idea called the progressive income tax. I think it should be simple. I think we do away with all of the corporate loopholes. I think corporations should be starting to pay their fair share of taxes. In that way, I think you can stabilize and or lower taxes on the middle class and on working people. Right now, if you had the same tax rates as we had in 1977 for the upper-income people, we'd have $80 billion or more a year coming into the federal coffers alone. So I believe in a simple, straightforward, progressive income tax.
Bernie Sanders, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Third-term Vermont Congress member, founder of the Progressive Caucus. And I want to remind our listeners that every single Wednesday, we will be bringing you members of the Progressive Caucus and other members in debate and discussion. Last week, it was Eleanor Holmes Norton talking about a future vision of America, which might be beginning right now. Salim Muakil, senior editor of In These Times in Chicago, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you tomorrow. We're headed out to California as well. We'll be broadcasting tomorrow and Friday from the Media and Democracy Congress to talk about media and bringing democracy to the media, which is a critical point in this day and age. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Coming up in just a minute, Juan Gonzalez of the Daily News and Dennis Rivera, union leader in New York. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. By the way, that We Shall Overcome, that was narrated, I guess you could say, by Bernie Sanders and 30 Vermont artists. You can get a copy of the tape if you'd like. You can call White Crow Records at 802-658-1270. That's 802-658-1270. But right now we're going up to New York to our studios at WBAI Radio, where Juan Gonzalez is standing by, or sitting, I hope. Juan Gonzalez, who is a columnist with the Daily News, who has a new book out, which is a collection of his columns called Roll Down Your Window, Stories from a Forgotten America. And I really recommend it to everyone, the idea of when you go into communities that you don't know, instead of locking up that door and rolling up your window, rolling it down. And you can do that by getting the book and taking a glimpse at an America that you may not know a lot about. Juan, welcome to Democracy Now!
Amy, good morning to you.
Morning. It's good and to hear you.
Yeah, we have this morning with us Dennis Rivera, who is the president of 1199, the National Health and Human Service Employees Union. It's one of the largest unions in New York City, about 117,000 members. And welcome, Dennis.
Welcome.
Dennis, I'd like to start out. Just last week it was announced that 1199 has rejoined the AFL-CIO after being an independent union outside the AFL structure for several years. What made you decide at this particular time to rejoin the AFL-CIO, seeing as it's going to cost you about $1 million a year in dues now that you've got to pay to the parent organization? What were the decisions that made your leadership decide to rejoin?
Well, what happened was that we think that there's a lot of changes in the AFL-CIO right now. We have seen the election of Mr. Sweeney as the president of the AFL-CIO and his commitment to fight for the progressive causes and reinvigorate the labor movement. And we believe that we were be accepted. We had asked during the tenure of Lane Kirkland for a charter, and we was denied. And now, under the leadership of Mr. Sweeney, we were accepted as a national organization.
When you say as a charter, in other words, as a union not affiliated to, because I know several years back there was talk that you might affiliate with the Service Employees International Union or with AFSCME, but now you're going to be an independent union. Does that mean you're going to be going out across the country to organize health workers, or will you stay within New York State?
Well, our goal, although we have the ability to go and organize all over the country as a national organization, at this moment, our objective is to concentrate in New York State.
Uh-huh. Now, in terms of the presidential race this year, what do you see as the critical role that labor can play? Everyone keeps talking about, or many in the dominant media keep talking about, the lack of power or the decline of the American labor movement. What do you see as the major roles that 1199 would like to see the AFL play in this presidential race?
Well, I think that particularly as it relates to the House of Representatives, right now we're working very closely with Congressman Gephardt to win back the House of Representatives. There's going to be about close to 150 races all over the country in which Republicans are going to be challenged. And we believe that if the elections were held today, the Democrats will win back the House of Representatives. So assisting in that effort by providing volunteers, identifying candidates, providing money for those campaigns, I think will be crucial. I think if we can win back the House of Representatives, that will be a significant contribution to change the course of events in America.
So you think that is even more important than retaining the White House for Bill Clinton and the Democrats? Or,
well, I believe at this moment that if the election were held today, President Clinton would be reelected, particularly for what's happening in the Republican Party in the primaries, that there's not a clear consensus of a candidate. Although in politics now we've seen that about 6 months is a lifetime, and many things could change. I believe that President Clinton has excellent chances of being reelected, and that by assisting winning back the House of Representatives, we can assist him to get reelected too.
Dennis, we're getting a little bit of a feedback. I don't know if you have your radio on or not, but if possible, if you could turn it off. But in terms of the
Juan, I do not have a radio here. It's in your station.
Okay, fine, no problem. We'll try to see what we can do to fix it. In terms of the situation with the, you have your vice president now. Jerry Hudson has been named the political director of the Democratic Party now for New York State. Is the union 1199 perhaps becoming too identified as within the structure of the Democratic Party? There's some, I guess, who are more progressive who would be saying that at this stage the union's progressive history is being too identified to the party.
Well, we believe that the first and primary reason that we have to, as assistants of the union, is to make the members of our union live a better life for them and their family. And at this crucial moment in history, the objective reality is that the Republicans are in control of the Senate, U.S. Senate, U.S. House of Representatives. They're in control of the government in New York State and in New York City and the New York State Senate. And we need to build the greatest coalition to stop them from assuming greater political concentration of their power. And we believe that inside the Democratic Party at this moment we have the best chances of stopping the Republican. And that's our analysis.
Well, but for instance, a couple of years back when the Democrats were in control of Congress and the president proposed a major health care reform, which I know you were heavily involved in, but even with the Democratic majorities, that health care reform that many Americans felt was so critical to their futures were not able to be passed. What makes you think that with a Democratic majority, even in the House, let's say, and in the White House, that things are going to change in terms of being able to get these substantive pieces of legislation that would affect people's lives passed in a way that would result in positive benefit for the people?
Well, there's a bitter debate inside the Democratic Party about which should be the policies that they should stand for. I believe that inside the Democratic Party we have to fight to have the most progressive party that responds to the needs of the people. In order for us to be in that debate, we need to be inside the Democratic Party. it's the polarization in American politics is more dramatic now than I could recall, as evidenced by the Republican prime. I believe that by participating in the Democratic Party, we can influence its direction. And that's what we believe. One, by the way, I got a terrible. I can hardly hear you.
Uh huh. I can hear you perfectly well. In terms of healthcare itself, there are major changes occurring within the healthcare industry. A lot of the both private hospitals are concentrating and building networks. What do you see as the critical changes in healthcare that are going to affect the average working class American over the next year or two or 5 years down the line that have to be addressed by progressives?
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in Washington studios, and Juan Gonzalez in our studios at WBAI Radio, and Dennis Rivera on the telephone. We're having a little trouble getting this echo out of his voice. Dennis Rivera, head of 1199, which is the local health and hospital workers union, a very powerful force in New York City politics. Let's see if we can hear them a little bit now. We also want to get into the question of how a union supports a Democratic Party that was pro-NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, as you heard Bernie Sanders just saying, extremely, even more so than Bush, very much President Clinton was pushing through this plan in Congress, and also ask him about health care and whether he was satisfied with the Clinton plan and how it is that it's dropped off the front pages of the papers just because Washington just doesn't want to emphasize it. You're listening to WBAI Radio in New York, WPFW here in Washington, D.C. And I want to let people know, as we just clear up the phone lines a little bit, for those who are calling in and asking for Bernie Sanders' CD, his recording, his tape, we want to let you know that you can call to get it. I'm a little surprised people want it, but, you know, to each his or her own. And you can call White Crow Records at 802-658-1270. That's 802-658-1270. And you can get a copy of Bernie Sanders and 30 Vermont artists singing and talking and doing whatever they're doing, We Shall Overcome. That's the way you can get that. Also, I want to let you know that on the next edition of Democracy Now!, that's tomorrow, Pacifica's daily election radio program, coverage of the Media and Democracy Congress, over 600 grassroots activists and progressive journalists from radio, television, print, and the internet are gathering in San Francisco to discuss the telecommunications bill and the threat to media monopolies, the threat that they pose to independent voices. The whole Democracy Now! Team, Salim Wakil, Juan Gonzalez, Larry Bensky, and I will be there. And we urge you to join Pacifica's Democracy Now! For coverage of this historic gathering and for a grassroots look at the state of American democracy and the state of the U.S. media. Let's go back now to New York with Juan Gonzalez and Dennis Rivera.
Yes, Dennis, in terms of, we were talking about the healthcare situation and the fact that it's gone off the front pages, but it's still a major issue for the average American. What do you see as what has to happen in terms of what progressives can do to impact on changes in healthcare policy in the country?
Well, the biggest problem that we have is that 41 million Americans do not have healthcare coverage right now, and that number is growing. And there's about 60 more million Americans who do not have adequate coverage. How we can rescue that debate again is very important. The debate on the healthcare debate of Clinton ended, the insurance companies ended controlling the debate. And at this moment, they are the people who are at the control of the process. In the past, the healthcare industry was driven by providers. Now is driven, namely healthcare institutions and facilities. Now it's by the insurance company.
And as long as they are dictating the terms of the delivery of health care, we are in a very bad situation in America.
But in terms of the mistakes that were made that did not allow a health care plan to pass, I mean, what mistakes were made on the part of more progressive or even within the Democratic Party that when they had a majority in Congress, they were not able to get a bill passed?
I think that it's starting with ourselves in 1199. We nitpickled too much, and we wanted such a perfect bill that we helped defeat it. I think that we should have accepted a broad concept and then try to win that and then improve it. I think by trying to fix all the fine details, we all assisted in the process of defeating that bill. Objectively speaking, we were not organized in the most scientific and best way across the country to make a campaign for national health care. The insurance companies were able to convince the 80% of Americans who have health care coverage that they will be in some way, shape, or form be affected by the debate I was having.
Well, in terms of the increased push toward privatization in healthcare, obviously in New York City, the public hospital system is being sold off little by little by the mayor, and throughout the country, for-profit healthcare operations are gaining in strength. What do you see as a strategy that can hold this back, and how can your union or other people in the health field bring health issues back onto the table as part of the national debate in this presidential election?
Well, we need to keep having the debate about what kind of society are we going to have. For example, in New York City, there is the guarantee that if you are sick and you don't have health care coverage, you can go to a public hospital and receive care. We need to fight for that value in our society. If we give up on that value, we lose as a society. And what we need to do is engage that debate and the moral question is there a rational expectation that people can receive health care whenever they need it, regardless of their ability to pay? And we need to have that crusade. And we need to enlist the religious leaders and the civic leaders and the people of goodwill in that in fight.
And the union, your union has a long history of massive mobilizations, of bringing people into the streets and into lobbying efforts both in Albany and in Washington around particular issues. And you've had a long good history of being able to organize people in large numbers. What do you see coming up in the next few months as the major direction that you're going to direct your forces to, both in New York City and in your influence throughout the country?
Well, we are planning on June the 1st. I'd like to repeat that date. On June 1st, the Children Defense Fund under the leadership of Marion Ryan.
Dennis, we're going to have to. I'm sorry, we're going to have to cut it. We're going to have to say goodbye right now. Thanks for being with us, and we hope to have you back again.
I want to thank Juan Gonzalez and Dennis Rivera, and let you know that tomorrow we'll give you the full details on those June 1st plans with the Children's Defense Fund and 1199. Juan, thanks for joining us from New York. And that ends another edition of Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Pat Greenfield and Carol Douglas. Our engineer is John O'Leary in Washington and Errol Maitland in New York. And if you'd like any copy of Democracy Now! Or the alternative State of the Union address by Bernie Sanders, our guest earlier today, you can call 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Join us for another edition of Democracy Now!, Pacifica's daily grassroots program covering the presidential campaign and the state of American democracy.